Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
The first one I'll read is the Vedana Samyutta, Samyutta 36, number 7, called the Sick Ward. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vaisali, in the great wood in the hall with the peaked roof. Then in the evening, the Blessed One emerged from seclusion and went to the sick ward, where he sat down in the appointed seat and addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, a bhikkhu should wait his time, mindful and clearly comprehending. This is our instruction to you. And how, bhikkhus, is a bhikkhu mindful? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu dwells contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having put away covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating feelings and feelings, mind and mind, phenomena and phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having put away covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. It is in such a way that a bhikkhu is mindful. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu exercise clear comprehension? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is one who acts with clear comprehension when going forward and returning, when looking ahead and looking aside, when drawing in and extending the limbs, when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, when eating, drinking, chewing his food and tasting, when defecating and urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, speaking, and keeping silent. It is in such a way that a bhikkhu exercises clear comprehension. A bhikkhu should await his time, mindful and clearly comprehending. This is our instruction to you. Bhikkhus, while a bhikkhu dwells thus, mindful and clearly comprehending, diligent, ardent, and resolute, if there arises in him a pleasant feeling, he understands thus, there has arisen in me a pleasant feeling. Now that is dependent, not independent. Dependent on what? Dependent on this very body. But this body is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen. So when the pleasant feeling has arisen in dependence on a body that is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, how could it be permanent? He dwells contemplating impermanence in the body and in pleasant feeling. He dwells contemplating vanishing, contemplating fading away, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. As he dwells thus, the underlying tendency to lust in regard to the body and in regard to pleasant feeling is abandoned by him. Bhikkhus, while a bhikkhu dwells thus, mindful and clearly comprehending, diligent, ardent, and resolute, if there arises in him a painful feeling, he understands thus, there has arisen in me a painful feeling. Now that is dependent, not independent. Dependent on what? Dependent on just this body. But this body is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen. So when the painful feeling has arisen in dependence on a body that is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, how could it be permanent? He dwells contemplating impermanence in the body and in painful feeling. He dwells contemplating vanishing, contemplating fading away, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. As he dwells thus, the underlying tendency to aversion in regard to the body and in regard to painful feeling is abandoned by him. Bhikkhus, while a bhikkhu dwells thus, mindful and clearly comprehending, diligent, ardent, and resolute, if there arises in him a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands thus, there has arisen in me a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Now that is dependent, not independent. Dependent on what? Dependent on just this body. But this body is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen. So when the neither painful nor pleasant feeling has arisen, in dependence on a body that is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, how could it be permanent? He dwells contemplating impermanence in the body and in neither painful nor pleasant feeling. He dwells contemplating vanishing, contemplating fading away, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. As he dwells thus, the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to the body and in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling is abandoned by him. If he feels a pleasant feeling, he understands it is impermanent. He understands it is not held to. He understands it is not delighted in. If he feels a painful feeling, he understands it is impermanent. He understands it is not held to. He understands it is not delighted in. If he feels a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands it is impermanent. He understands it is not held to. He understands it is not delighted in. If he feels a pleasant feeling, he feels it detached. If he feels a painful feeling, he feels it detached. If he feels a neither pleasant nor painful feeling, he feels it detached. When he feels a feeling terminating with the body, he understands, I feel a feeling terminating with the body. When he feels a feeling terminating with life, he understands, I feel a feeling terminating with life. And I did a quick check, just so people know, on that particular phrase, terminating with the body, because I found it a bit confusing. And Lungpa suggested I look up Ajahn Jeff's translation. And I think it is actually a little more clear that, and he says, when he feels a feeling limited to the body, he understands, I feel a feeling limited to the body. When he feels a feeling limited to life, he understands, I feel a feeling limited to life, which I think is more clear. He understands, with the breakup of the body following the exhaustion of life, all that is felt, not being delighted in, will become cool right here. Just as bhikkhus, an oil lamp burns in dependence on the oil and the wick, and with the exhaustion of the oil and the wick, it is extinguished through lack of fuel, so too bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu feels a feeling limited to the body, limited to life, he understands, with the breakup of the body, following the exhaustion of life, all that is felt, not being delighted in, will become cool right here. So I think that's a really nice example of really using the contemplation of feeling at very significant moments. And supposedly on the sick ward, there were many of these bhikkhus who were moving towards the end of their life. So what better way to go out with the Buddha than with the Buddha instructing you on what to do with all these different feelings and how to use it for relinquishment.
Are there any interpretations of what the, I suppose what the metaphor to, you know, that to become cool right here is sort of referring to?
I think when he says, all that is felt will become cool right here, it's referring to if a person has followed these instructions and really let go of attachment to feelings and really seen them clearly as they are, as impermanent, and suffering and not self, then the implication is that, that is the end of complete involvement with craving for any of these kinds of feeling or experience, and essentially is synonymous with liberation, as far as I understand. Makes sense.
It's probably the verb nibbutong, become cool, which is kind of the verb form of nibbana.
Nibbana.
Yes.
Okay, move on to the next one. This is Sanyutta 36, number 21, Siwaka. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Then the wanderer Molyasiwaka approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this. Whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, all that is caused by what was done in the past. What does Master Gotama say about this? Some feelings, Siwaka, arise here originating from bile disorders. That some feelings arise here originating from bile disorders, one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this, whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant, painful, or neither pleasant, painful nor pleasant, all that is caused by what was done in the past, they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins. Some feelings, Siwaka, arise here originating from phlegm disorders, originating from wind disorders, originating from an imbalance of the three, produced by change of climate, careless behavior, caused by assault, produced as the result of kama. How some feelings arise here, produced as a result of kama, one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine as this, whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, all that is caused by what was done in the past, they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins. When this was said, the wanderer Molyasiwaka said to the Blessed One, Magnificent Master Gotama, Magnificent Master Gotama, from today let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. Bile, phlegm, and also wind, imbalance and climate too, carelessness and assault, with calmer result as the eighth. I thought that was just kind of an interesting treatise on the fact that everything isn't kama. All experience isn't a result of kama. There are natural phenomena in the world, related to weather, climate, fact that we have a human body, and that it's stretching too far to say everything has a cause from some sort of past action, past experience. We have pain.
It's interesting also that it includes assault.
Assault, yes, yeah.
There's so many people said,
what did I do wrong? That
you must have done some bad karma with that person in the past. Or you
yeah. I was just standing here.
Total wacko.
But you hear that a lot, monks saying that, or
yeah.
That's even in the Abhidhamma. Even the Abhidhamma says all made in a from past karma. So, I mean, that's it.
Well, what are the reasons why Abhidhamma is? What Ajahn Buddhadasa called too much Dhamma.
That's why a lot of monks take it, because it's in there. It's like, oh, I can point to the Abhidhamma.
Abhi means a lot, too much. That's a child. Abhidhamma says 1 + 1 = 2. I just say 2.
That's great. Yeah, it can get very, the whole workings of kama can get really taken to an extreme. Even in scenes, like some of the teachings when I was practicing in Tibetan tradition, there was some real, there's a whole text called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons that talks about the real specific aspects of how, even certain aspects of certain diseases have specific and exact causes that are inevitable, and you know, it just seems so, it's pretty.
It's enough to make your head explode.
It is. If you have bad enough karma.
I think that, you know, being able to appreciate that, you know, people just get sick for the sake of getting sick, as opposed to their karma, also can be a good practice for compassion. You know, I feel like sometimes, oh, it's just their karma, and, you know, they kind of deserve what's happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you realize that disease is one of those noble truths, that karma is really what it's all about.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, there is some sort of karma, I mean, but it's the karma of having a human body, you know? It's like, you know, we get sick and we die because we were born, you know? So, but it's not, like, related to something you did wrong, you know?
It's not called, like, proximate cause. Yeah. Like, it's not the next thing.
Right.
We still cling, and therefore we have a body, therefore we get sick, but it's not...
Right, right.
It always seems to me when people say things like, you know, if their karma and the implication is I shouldn't generate compassion or something, it always seemed like bad karma to me. I don't know, I mean, it's just like, I don't know, it always seemed incongruous, and I don't know. It's their karma. It's like, I don't want to deal with it. It just seems like not a skillful response to the situation. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that was sort of the original and still dominant perception of karma in the Hindu sense and the Buddhist and the Brahminical sense. There's a lot of different connotations, but yeah, destiny or fate is the connotation that's dominant in Western and Hindu philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that can be picked up with a bit of a dismissive or blaming, judgmental attitude.
Oh, it's a good way to simplify things.
Yeah.
Then you don't have to think about it too much. Take responsibility.
Sometimes I do think too, kind of on the other hand, it's like it can be a useful thing if, you know, a person is really wrapped up in, you know, this isn't fair, this isn't, you know, this isn't right, this shouldn't be this way, right? And it's sort of like, well, then sometimes, in some cases, that the explanation of karma can be also, for unexplainable circumstances, you know, sort of like it can reduce that obsession with, you know, the injustice of life.
Ajahn Munindo, one time, Ajahn Munindo was, he had both his knees operated on at the same time. It went badly. He was in hospital for a long time, and you know, feeling very sorry for himself, and that it shouldn't be this way. It's completely unjust and unfair. And Ajahn Chah went to visit him, so he sort of dumped all that onto Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah just said, if it wasn't supposed to be this way, it wouldn't have been this way. He didn't give him any room at all. Why? And Ajahn Munindo really appreciated
it.
Really stuck with him over the years.
Yeah.
Is that the first time he said that?
Huh?
Is that the first time?
Oh, who knows?
No.
I don't know. I mean, there's lots of people lying, so he probably had lots of opportunities to say it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the reflection on karma, which is the way to cultivate equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Precisely so.
Even the tsunami in Thailand, it was all over the newspapers. It's their karma. really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's close to the Christian version of it's the punishment of God.
Exactly. Is it because you're a sinner?
Right.
But the other one for Thai people that's very helpful is like they say Kambun Makani, like somebody die. Kambun Makani. It's very, very positive feeling, I think.
Yes.
What do I think?
Well, it depends how it's held.
Uh-huh.
Because it can be held in a compassionate way,
mm-hmm.
or it can be held in a dismissive way.
Right.
You know, it depends how it's held.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the translation?
The translation is sort of like, well, if somebody's died or ill, then you sort of think, you sort of say, well, that's as far as their merit. Take some sort of thing. That's a euphemism for death in the Thai language is, oh, your merit's finished. What would?
Good night.
But it has a, depends on the talent.
Okay, I think I'm going to go ahead and do one reading. It might take us over a few minutes, but it's a nice way to, I think, wrap up these few readings on Vedana. And this is from Ajahn Viradamo, from this book, The Stillness of Being. Ajahn Janako found this reading that it's part of a talk on, the talk itself is entitled The End of Rebirth, and the section where he starts talking a little bit about Veda Nupassana is a few pages into it. Last night we talked about craving, tanha, the sense of wanting to become, wanting to get rid of, or simply wanting something essentially nice. Craving is a fundamental human characteristic, neither right nor wrong, just part of the package. The three kinds of tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, and kama tanha, should be understood. Bhava tanha is the craving for being. Notice when we are on retreat, how much we are being something or someone. Sometimes there is a feeling of being kidnapped by the memory. We find ourselves back in time. Or maybe it is a future possibility. In thought, there is the sense of being a person, of becoming, through anticipation and expectation. If we are not aware of that, then our attention will be preoccupied, kidnapped by a constant level of stress in the mind. Then there is vibhava tanha, which is repression. We have a lot of ideals about what we should not be and what we should not have. Vibhava tanha is the desire to get rid of those things. Kama tanha is the craving for sense pleasure. Around the body, there is a lot of kama tanha. We like comfort in this body. We don't like arthritis or pain. Yet one of the lessons in this life, for some seemingly cruel reason, is that we need to witness to bodily pain. That is part of life. So on the social level, we deal with the pain. We find some Chinese herbs or get the acupuncturist to poke us. Whatever we have faith in, we work on that level. But on the Dhamma level, we reflect. There is sickness. Why is there sickness? Because there is birth. That is just the way it is, like it or not. So sickness is something which needs to be learned about, as is pain. On a retreat, you get pain. I hope you don't get too sick or pained, but you'll probably feel some pain, in the knees or the back or somewhere. So there is pain and there is craving for comfort. That is a basic fundamental instinct which needs to be understood. Now, if one can understand the craving for non-pain and be at peace with pain, then one obviously has done oneself a great service. So try to use the feeling of pain to examine craving, to understand the wanting and see the end of wanting. The same holds true for the emotions and the way sense consciousness works. The Buddha encouraged us to consider how human consciousness and the human body are involved with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings and sensations. To use feeling Vedana as a framework for contemplation or investigation. When you are thirsty, you drink a glass of orange juice. It is pleasant. When you are sitting here and your knees hurt, that is unpleasant. That is very obvious. So no matter what you are finding pleasant or unpleasant, the body, the weather, a person, or the content of your mind, notice the feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and then consider these feelings in relation to the arising of attraction, repulsion, neutrality. When we are not in touch with Dhamma, we often don't consider these fundamental states of mind. We just enjoy the pleasant and try to minimize the unpleasant, which seems like a logical thing to do. But then that keeps us very restless, because no matter how hard we try to do this, there will always be pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Sense consciousness is this way. Seeking the pleasant, trying to be rid of the unpleasant, is samsara. The more we do this, the more we want to do it, and the more we have to do it. We become addicted to this way of operating. We get into this very restless phenomenon called rebirth. Becoming, doing, all the time. And this takes us away from our real home. This takes us away from the unconditioned, because pleasure and pain are always conditioned. As they change, we feel the need to change. As we grasp pleasure and pain, we find ourselves being spun around the samsaric wheel. The wheel is one of our traditional images. The rim of the wheel represents sense experience, the contacts we experience, pleasant and unpleasant, all of it spinning around. Grasping the rim of a wheel simply swings us around with the general momentum. So grasping the pleasant, then trying to hold on to it and being afraid of losing it, we make tremendous effort to keep it going. Getting angry at the unpleasant. In both cases, we continue to spin around endlessly. But the hub of the wheel is the center of knowing and being, and this point of stillness can contain it all. This is where the unconditioned lies. If we can summon awareness and be that still center of knowing, there are still comings and goings, but we have a refuge. This is what Ajahn Chah called our real home. This is the basic structure that the Buddha asks us to look at. Our sensitive body contacts objects. That contact produces pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings. From there comes craving, the grasping of craving, and the whole process of becoming and rebirth. If one carries on like this over time, it becomes a habit. It is then very difficult to return to the still center of being, because one is so restlessly engaged with that which moves, with the emotions and the thoughts. Why are we kidnapped so much? Even though we sit here determining, I will not get kidnapped, it's very hard, isn't it? Don't think you are alone in this. We are all in the same boat. It is very difficult because of our habits, our conditioning. Even though we might have really good intentions, situations arise when we feel anger or fear. What we are trying to do is to break up all these karmic patterns. The way to do this is by beginning to look at Dhamma rather than remaining stuck on the level of personality. The contemplation of feelings is one of the four foundations of mindfulness. It requires careful attention to notice this basic structure of the way that some things attract our attention while others repel us. We can try it with an emotion, with a bodily feeling, with a thought, or with people. On this retreat, maybe you experience difficulty with another person, or maybe you fall in love with someone. Notice how some people are physically very attractive, while some are not. Some people have a lot of charisma, and others don't. Notice how you are attracted or repelled. Look at that very simple movement of the heart. This is where our habitual emotions are really arising from. Sometimes when you are sitting, the mind is bored. The eyes look around and you find yourself attracted to someone. Ah, and then you start to create. Romance. There is the creation of me and that person and what we are going to do, what is going to happen to us. Sometimes this is called a vipassana marriage. And then unexpectedly, the bell rings. It can happen with hatred too. For example, when there is something unappealing about someone, rather than just noticing our desire to pull away from them, sitting with that until it reaches neutrality, we become very critical, caught in aversion, and try to push them away. But in contemplation of feelings, we can simply bring up an image of a person and be mindful of the attraction or aversion. That takes us to peace of the mind, to neutrality, rather than identification with the feeling itself. If you can know that movement of feelings and learn not to follow or react, then you begin not to suffer. For example, your own psyche, the things you don't like about yourself, the emotions you think should not be there, all these come up as very unpleasant. So ask yourself, what does an unpleasant emotion feel like? Or in meditation, you might sometimes experience tranquility, bliss, or bright lights, or notice how beautiful silence is, how really attractive that is. But then comes the coarse sound of an earth-moving machine. So we attach to the pleasant and the refined, and we try to get rid of the ugly. But what is it that knows pleasant and unpleasant? Quite often we are so caught up with the craving for pleasure that we don't even notice neutrality, which we find boring. As Ajahn Chah said, the neutral, the ordinary, is like the space between the end of the out-breath and the beginning of the in-breath. It is very calming, but we don't tend to notice it because we want excitement. We seek to react to interesting, difficult, or frightening things. The practice of Vedanupassana requires refined attention, taking this theme for contemplation in order to break down the whole self structure. So no matter what you may be as a self, as a person, suggest to yourself that today you are simply going to try to notice attraction and repulsion in the mind. That way you are contemplating Dhamma instead of just being a person. Then ask, what is it that knows that which I am noticing? That knowing is where we find our freedom. The structure is very analytical, but in Buddhism we need a certain amount of analysis. You have a body with senses. You live in an environment with which you have contact. That contact produces pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. Right there is where you work. Then you have tanha, wanting the pleasant, not wanting the unpleasant, or the sleepiness and delusion around the neutrality. When that wanting arises, there might be grasping of it, believing in it. You really think that if you follow it, you will be truly happy, or that to get rid of it will be the right thing to do. So there is this belief in the wanting and the grasping, upadana. From the grasping comes the sense of becoming. One gets involved in this whole process and is reborn into the new situation. From there emerges the sense of dissatisfaction, and you get lost in that. Oh, here I go again. These are wonderful opportunities to notice how birth and death operate moment by moment. For example, I am bored with meditation, knees hurting, and so I want to get up and do something interesting. Suddenly, a creative idea that is really going to help the world pops into my mind. Rather than simply noticing this as an idea with a pleasant feeling, I want to stay interested. So craving and involvement keep the idea fermenting in my mind. From the boredom, my attention gets reborn into pleasant or exciting thoughts. Eventually, the pleasant thoughts get boring, and so the cycle goes on and on. Each arising of a birth means there must eventually be a death. It is important to notice the point where the mind moves to yet another interesting topic, for this is where we have a choice. If I can see the craving to get away from the boredom, and in turn not grasp the clever and seemingly important ideas, then the mind settles down into silence, and the cycle of rebirth has been abandoned. If, however, I choose to grasp the pleasant idea as a way of escaping the boredom, then the mind stays busy with many little cycles of birth and death. Disillusionment, disappointment, and boredom bring us into the same kind of cyclic thinking. This is why it is important to notice these as states of mind and be patient until they subside of their own accord. In this way, we develop mindful forbearance, and that is what brings us to the peace of non-becoming. So we choose. Sometimes we are able to notice the movement towards pleasure, and we can say to ourselves, Is this necessary? Will it lead to peace? We don't just react heedlessly to the feelings of boredom and disappointment. Our choices are based upon wisdom rather than ignorance. In a very immediate way, we can realize the ending of the restless cycles of discontent in our inner world. We are then walking on the path of peace and approaching the end of rebirth. Very nice selection from Ajahn V. Any other last thoughts, comments? Okay.
Namaya dhammakataya sadhukaram dadamase
sadhu sadhu.